Count Adolf V of Berg stood on the banks of the Rhine some 50 kilometers north of Cologne. Here on 14th August 1288, he looked across to the neighboring bank on the left bank of the Rhine and knew that the town of Neuss lay just one bend of the river further on. That ancient town, Neuss, which had already flourished in Roman times, was once again firmly in the hand of the Archbishop of Cologne at that time. It was an ideal location from which to control and levy taxes on this stretch of the Rhine River. So, what he was about to do here would be something that would greatly anger the Archbishop of Cologne. Under normal circumstances, it would immediately trigger a feud, a full-blown regional war. The Archbishop's allies would advance on Berg territory from all sides. He, the Count of Berg, had himself been a vassal of the Archbishop of Cologne since the time went back. But that 14th August 1288 was no ordinary occasion. Adolf V could not help but smile. None of the Archbishop's vassals would attack him for what he was about to do here, and least of all the Archbishop himself, for the current incumbent, Siegfried von Westerburg, was too busy to be of any help. Siegfried was being held captive in Adolf V's castle in Solingen. He was powerless to act and entirely at the mercy of the Count of Berg. The Battle of Worring had taken place just under 2 months earlier, and Adolf had emerged victorious. His spoils, his chief enemy, the Archbishop of Cologne, taken as his prisoner. The Lord of Berg could not let this opportunity, this historic opportunity, for his county slip. So he turned round and looked at the residents present here and his entourage who had traveled with him. The locals were just a handful of farmers. Nevertheless, Adolf V spoke with great joy and announced with pride, "Dear people of Düsseldorf, I hereby grant you town rights for your settlements." On to the intro. Did it really happen like that? I may have embellished a little. But the historical fact is true. On 14th August 1288, the small settlement on the Rhine called Düsseldorf was granted town privileges. That would not have been possible before. A town belonging to the Count of Berg right on the Rhine, unthinkable in the eyes of the Archbishop of Cologne. But a power vacuum had arisen, and Adolf V of Berg had exploited it whilst the Archbishop of Cologne remained his personal prisoner. And with that, welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the history of the city of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old, but until it became what it is today, this old city on the Rhine has endured a colorful and rich past, hence it can therefore be seen as a microcosm of European history. In this podcast, you can listen as the city grows from the Romans up until our present time. What an episode that was last time. The Battle of Worringen had raged outside the walls of Cologne, and virtually the entire northwest of the empire had taken part in it. It was here that the Limburg War of Succession was decided in favor of the side comprising of Berg, Brabant and the city of Cologne. We'll come to the consequences in a moment. The defeated party was the Archbishop of Cologne, but why had he lost the battle? After all, he'd even had more troops at his disposal and above all, more knights during the battle. Historical research has identified two key moments in particular. Right at the start, the Archbishop made the fatal mistake of pivoting towards the center of the enemy's lines after provisionally crushing their left wing. In doing so, he clashed with his Luxembourg allies. Admittedly, they formed an overwhelming force, which the Brabant opposition clearly struggled to cope with. The second turning point also occurred among the Archbishop's allies as the battle progressed. A large proportion of the allied troops from Geldern refused to take an active part in the battle and attempted, unsuccessfully, to plunder the Brabant camp, which they believed to be unguarded. This allowed Brabant to withdraw troops from that flank and send them into the fray at the center. That, effectively, decided the battle. The late attack by the initially repelled Cologne forces and the Berg peasants should, of course, not be underestimated. However, their participation was not decisive for the outcome of the battle. By then, the Luxembourgers were all dead, and the Archbishop of Cologne was trapped in the thick of the battle, unable to maneuver. Other accounts are likely to be a case of modern local patriotism on the part of Cologne or even Düsseldorf. The achievements of the foot soldiers from Cologne and Berg should not be downplayed, but as I said, the battle was as good as decided by that point. So you see, historians like me are spoil sports. What was the significance of the Battle of Vorringen? From a military historical perspective, as I said, it was one of the greatest battles between knights in the German Middle Ages. When it comes to the political assessment, I've also come across differing viewpoints. Which of these do I find more convincing? I have no idea. Perhaps the answer lies somewhere, as always, in the middle. For some historians, it marks a turning point in the history of the northwest of the Holy Roman Empire. The battle prevented the Archbishop of Cologne from continuing to expand his power and establishing a dominant, contiguous territorial state. Places such as Berg or Jülich would then, on paper, still have existed, yes, but only as a mere vassal of low rank. It was precisely this that the well-known outcome of the Battle of Vorringen prevented. The Archbishop of Cologne was not only halted in his quest for power, but actually pushed back. That is one view. The other view holds that the Battle of Vorringen was, of course, significant due to its scale and the number of participants. Politically, however, it would have changed little that was not already in the offing, namely the curbing of the Archbishop's secular power and greater independence for the other secular rulers in the region, as described here. This would have happened even without this bloody battle. Likewise, Cologne would in effect have shaken off the Archbishop's rule. These are the two views I have come across, which interestingly enough nevertheless arrive at the same conclusion. The Archbishop loses. For many parts of the Lower Rhine region, and indeed for the city of Cologne itself, the full implications of the battle were not immediately apparent, yet it was soon incorporated into their own collective memory. In Cologne, a few years after the battle, a chapel was built in the Severinsviertel, the suburb in the south of the city, dedicated to Saint Boniface. His feast day fell on 5th June, the very day on which the Battle of Vorringen was traditionally commemorated each year. There, the Cologne City Council celebrated the victory at Vorringen every year. The Battle of Vorringen was also depicted in the Codex Manes. It's French, I believe, and you know I can't speak French, dating from around 1300, the largest German song manuscript of the Middle Ages, right up to the present day. In 1893, the Düsseldorf painter Peter Jansen the Elder painted a historical painting intended to depict that the scene at the end of the Battle of Vorringen, how the monk Walter Dodde called upon the Bergish peasants to go into battle. The painting deliberately omits the fact that they did so alongside the citizens of Cologne. The rivalry between Düsseldorf and Cologne as competing industrial cities was already all too real at that time. As recently as 1988, the city of Düsseldorf treated itself to a new monument commemorating the Battle of Vorringen, known as the Stadterhebungsdenkmal, meaning City Elevation Monument. The bronze collage was unveiled in the Old Town to mark the 700th anniversary. Yet it took around 100 years before Düsseldorf even began to feel the effects after 1288. It was not until around 1380 that the Lords of Berg left their ancestral seat, Schloss Burg in Solingen, and made Düsseldorf their new capital. The rest, as they say, is history. Alongside Brabant and the city of Cologne, the House of Berg was one of the great victors of the Battle of Vorringen. From then on, it was able to develop as a territory in its own right outside the Archdiocese of Cologne and help the region now known as Bergisches Land, so Bergish land, to forge its own identity, of which it remains proud to this day. The founding of Düsseldorf, for example, too, or the ability to mint own coins independently. Here, Berg was no longer dependent on the Archbishop of Cologne. However, the great political gain failed to materialize. Independence was the greatest achievement for the county of Berg. With the elevation of Berg from a county to a duchy in 1380, the Archbishop's final claim to be the feudal lord over the House of Berg was forever lost. Whilst the House of Berg's possessions were largely situated to the east of the Archbishopric of Cologne, the county of Jülich was, in effect, its western counterpart. Once a powerful ally of the city of Cologne and citizens, Jülich did not quite manage to regain its former splendor during that period, and this was despite the fact that it had been among the victors at the Battle of Vorringen. Victorious Brabant, too, saw no benefit in further strengthening a direct neighbor. As with the House of Berg, independence was the most important achievement here for Jülich. And in 1346, the king elevated the county of Jülich to a duchy as well. The main loser in political terms was of course the Archbishop of Cologne. With the support of the House of Gelder in Luxembourg, he had hoped to retain the upper hand in the Lower Rhine region. Had he won the battle, a contiguous domain dominated by the Archbishop would well have emerged in the northwest of the empire, with the Archbishop of Cologne as a powerful duke, speaking hypothetically, of course, as this never actually came to pass. Instead, the opposite occurred. The secular political influence of the Church of Cologne was greatly diminished. Added to this was the de facto loss of its own capital, although I realized there were not such things as capitals back then, namely Cologne. Siegfried von Westerburg would never see Cologne again, let alone set foot here, until his death. However, the Archbishops of Cologne had not lost control of Cologne entirely. There would be repeated attempts to strike a balance regarding the powers that still remained with the Archbishop inside the city. At times, a pragmatic coexistence even prevailed. Weyram von Jülich, for example, the Archbishop had himself buried in Cologne Cathedral in the mid-14th century. And this shows that there was a kind of agreement even after Vorringen between the city and the Archbishop. But I jumped ahead of time. Back then, the Archbishop who lost the Battle of Vorringen, Siegfried von Westerburg, he had to bite the bullet when it came to the other rulers. For around a year, between 1288 and 1289, he was held captive at Castle Schlossburg in what is now the city of Solingen, as a personal prisoner of the Count of Berg, who was in fact an archiepiscopal vassal and was now holding his own feudal lord captive. And even though this has been disproved by historical research, the claim persisted for a long time that during his captivity, the Archbishop of Cologne had to wear his armor every single day so that the whole world could see that the Count of Berg was not holding a poor, modest, and pious bishop captive, but a true warlord and military commander. The claim is, of course, nonsense, but it nevertheless illustrates that it must have been extremely humiliating for Siegfried von Westerburg to be in the hands of a foreign power, of a former vassal. During his captivity, Siegfried von Westerburg was forced to accept, not entirely of his own volition, that with Düsseldorf, the House of Berg had advanced as far as the Rhine River and was now posing a significant threat to him here, opposite of his own city, Neuss. The Archbishop was also compelled to give assurances that he would not erect any fortifications on the border with the County of Berg. At the same time, groups of citizens from Cologne, Berg, Mark, and Brabant traveled through the territory ruled by the Archbishop of Cologne and ravaged the Archbishop's castles, seizing the opportunity. The loss or destruction of these castles was, of course, a further political setback for the Archbishops. You know, castles are expensive, and if they get destroyed, that's even more bad. When Siegfried von Westerburg was released on 6 July 1289, and permitted to leave Schlossburg, the Count of Berg had wrested 12,000 marks in silver from him, secured the remission of all ecclesiastical penalties, and reclaimed the right to mint coins for his territory, a right which the Archbishop had only taken away from the House of Berg in 1279. During his imprisonment, Siegfried had fallen seriously ill and would need some time to regain his health again. In the aftermath of the Battle of Vorringen, the Count of Mark secured the rights of Bailiwick over the monastery in Essen. Not only was this monastery incredibly wealthy, but it was precisely for this reason that some 60 years earlier, in 1225, an Archbishop of Cologne had been murdered in a dispute over it, you know, Engelbert von Berg. By gaining control of Essen, the Count of Mark had not only secured a lucrative economic enterprise at the expense of the Archbishop of Cologne, but also a key stronghold along the so-called Hellweg, the east-west trade route of that era. This permanently weakened the Archbishop of Cologne's position in Westphalia. So for you Americans, the Count of Merak has now access to Route 66. Another major loser was the Count of Geldern. He too was captured by his enemies at the Battle of Worringen. Even before the battle, Count Reinhard von Geldern had been heavily in debt, as he had spent several years unsuccessfully attempting to establish himself as the new Duke of Limburg, until he sold his claims to Limburg to Luxembourgers for the tidy sum of 40,000 marks of silver. The only problem was that at that time of his capture at the Battle of Worringen, he had not yet received the sum from the Luxembourgers. And since all the Luxembourgers had been killed at the Battle of Worringen, he never did receive it. This spelled financial ruin for the Count of Geldern. Naturally, he also had to renounce his claims to Limburg. Financially ruined from 1290 onwards, the Count of Geldern leased out his estates and the entire county for 5 years in order to pay off his creditors. In Limburg, everyone was a loser. The local nobility had fallen out and fought one another at Worringen. The land there lay in ruins. Monasteries, farms, villages were devastated. And yet, in the medium term, Limburg would flourish once more under Brabant rule, and later, when it became part of Burgundy, it would flourish under Burgundian rule in the late Middle Ages. The greatest victor of the Battle of Worringen was, of course, Brabant. Duke John I was able to further extend his power towards the Rhineland. He regarded his victory as so significant that from then on his coat of arms featured both the Brabant Lion and the Limburg Lion in a quartered design in his coat of arms. Admittedly, Brabant too had suffered economically as a result of the Long War. However, because John's power had already been firmly established here at an early stage and he maintained a much stronger local presence, he was able to recover from this war quickly. Brabant, together with Limburg, fell to Burgundy some 140 years later, thereby fueling its rise as a late medieval power, at times on par with France and the Holy Roman Empire as a third country between, yeah, so to speak, Germany and France. And since I know that there are many, many medieval history buffs among my listeners who love Burgundy, without the Battle of Worringen, there would be no Burgundy as we know it from the history books. And we can take this line of thought even further. Without this Burgundy, shaped by the Battle of Worringen, large parts of which later fell to the Habsburgs in 1482, the subsequent German dualism between Prussia and Austria would not have emerged, a dualism that would shape German history, particularly in the 19th century. Right, but enough of looking so far into the future for now. The Luxembourgs were also on the losing side at the Battle of Worringen, but as great as the human tragedy was, it proved to be of little consequence for the future of this noble house. The son of the Luxembourg count who fell at the Battle of Worringen would become king of the Holy Roman Empire in 1308, and after him came others, such as Wenceslaus, who would bring Prague to its golden age in the middle of the 14th century. But hey, this is still, I know we slid off slightly, but this is still a podcast about the city of Cologne. What were the consequences for the city? Let's finally turn to Cologne then, which is after all the subject of this podcast, as I said. For the city of Cologne, it was a tremendous victory on paper, or rather on parchment. They had defeated their own feudal lord. And in doing so, they had effectively secured the city's independence. In many works on Cologne's history, the account is simplified to suggest that from then on everything was wonderful and Cologne was a free city, no archbishop anymore, yay! And there's some truth in that, of course. Following the victorious battle, the Cologne troops set about, together with their allies, razing the archbishop's castle at Worringen and other places. In other words, destroying it so that it would no longer pose a threat to the city's trade routes. As a visible sign of victory, the stones from the castle of Worringen were transported to Cologne on carts and symbolically incorporated into the city walls. Boss move. What was also brought about by his sheer and forced absence of the archbishop was that the high court of the archbishop lost a great deal of power over the city, which was taken over by the Cologne City Council, Many of the levies and taxes that the archbishop had imposed within the city were either abolished or placed under the city's own administration. This, of course, made Cologne a little richer once again. And as I said, Archbishop Siegfried von Westerburg, he never returned to Cologne. After his death, he was buried in what is now Bonn Minster. From the time of Worringen onwards, Bonn, along with a few other places, became in effect the permanent main residence of the Cologne archbishops. And therein lies the irony. For centuries, the archbishops of Cologne were not Cologne-based at all. Although later archbishops were permitted to travel to Cologne for liturgical services, this was only allowed with the permission of the city council of Cologne and under strict guard. So, is everything well now for Cologne? Is Cologne a free and proud city? Not quite. It was to take almost 200 years before Cologne officially attained the status of a free imperial city. De facto, however, it's true, the archbishop no longer had much to say here, being the simplified version. So expect to hear less about archbishops here in this podcast from now on, but they will not be gone for good. They will still appear here. Some of you will be pleased about that. I'm sure that we will not only talk about archbishops now anymore. The Battle of Worringen claimed between 700 and 1,000 lives on the Cologne side. This was particularly the case during the archbishop's decisive first attack in the Battle of Worringen before noon. With a population of around 40,000, half of whom were likely male, that amounts to up to 5% of all male residents who perished here in this battle. Mind you, this happened in a single day, in a single battle, an enormous toll of loss of life. In the immediate aftermath of the Battle of Worringen, however, further conflicts arose. This was despite an agreement dated 18th June 1288 between the city and his former lord. For Siegfried von Westerburg did not accept that he had been stripped of this position. He was to continue fighting until his death in 1297, albeit no longer primarily with the sword. Furthermore, he demanded the sum of 200,000 marks of silver from the city of Cologne as compensation, a sum that was far too high in regard as madness, even by his contemporaries. This was in punishment for the illegal change of allegiance shortly before the Battle of Worringen and the resulting loss of revenue since then for the archbishop. How did Cologne deal with this demand for payment? Quite simply, the city refused simply to pay. Consequently, the ecclesiastical penalties against the city remained in place for almost 10 years, the interdict. This placed enormous burden on everyone in the city, but to be honest, Cologne was used to it. It was not such a harsh penalty anymore. And as I said, I'm trying here, unlike many folkloric accounts, not to portray this as a conflict between good and evil, good Cologne between the evil archbishop, but rather as a clash between power blocks, the archbishop and his subordinates on the one hand, versus the city's wealthier citizens on the other. And this is where the unsavory aspects come to light. As we know, the Jews had always been able to rely on the archbishop's protection, though, as we know, not always. As mentioned, this protection should be viewed with caution. But now with the archbishop's expulsion out of the city, also the city that wants a share of the profits from the city's Jewish community, whose quarter lies right in the heart of the city, the Jews are soon to face a double financial burden. The archbishop cheerfully continues to collect his dues, but the city of Cologne is now also demanding payment for this so-called protection, with many consequences to come. Following the euphoria over the victory at Worringen, a sense of disillusionment is spreading through the city. The many deaths in the battle have left their mark, and neither the king nor any greater extent the Pope were prepared for the time being to make any further concessions to the city or to grant its privileges. The bitter realization, however, was this. Cologne had freed the city from the archbishop, but nothing more. The power of Cologne citizens ended immediately beyond the city walls. Directly behind them, in the open space, the archbishop continued to rule, and the archbishops saw no reason to relinquish their claim to Cologne, despite Worringen. For centuries to come, the city was now an island within the secular domain ruled by the Archbishop of Cologne, like West Berlin surrounded by communist East Germany. Cologne's territorial expansion was thus no longer possible. Geographically, the city became fixed within the boundaries that had existed since 1180, and that was to remain, brace yourselves, for around 700 years. A clear geographical disadvantage for Cologne. Not yet so noticeable in 1288. At that time, Cologne was still the largest city in medieval Germany. But a city like Nuremberg would eventually overtake Cologne by the end of the Middle Ages, partly because it possessed further territory beyond its city walls in the countryside, which could also be expanded and used for expansion for the city. Economically, too, the long-term consequences were not all positive. The archbishop's taxes and levies, which had previously been collected within the city, may well have ended up in his own pocket. However, the days of Cologne having its own currency were over. The Cologne penny was no longer minted in Cologne, lost much of its significance as a super-regional currency, and was replaced by the coin called Heller. In my view, the Battle of Worringen was a significant turning point for the city of Cologne, simply because of the event itself. However, many of the consequences I have described here only became apparent in the long term. In the short term, the political situation remained tense. Although Cologne was, in effect, free from the Archbishop, Siegfried von Westerburg was unwilling to relinquish his claims. So why didn't he go to war again? Quite simply, he had no money left to do so. He died in Bonn in 1297, and the ecclesiastical penalties imposed on Cologne remained in place for the time being. Would things improve under his successor? I think we leave it at that for now. The last few episodes of the podcast have covered quite a lot of national history, so to speak. I'm really looking forward to taking you on a narrative journey here on a small scale once again. Although I too, I'm sad to have now finished this significant part of Cologne's history, the Battle of Worringen. I'd been looking forward to it ever since the podcast began. But never mind, as the Romans used to say, tempus fugit. So next time we'll focus on something a bit more local. Be surprised. My sources were Ulrich Lenhardt's The Battle of Worringen, Warfare in the Middle Ages, Vera Turunsky, Worringen 1288, and The Name of Freedom, 1288 to 1988, Aspects of Cologne's History from Worringen to the Present Days. Thank you for listening. Recommend my podcast to anybody who loves history. And until next time, auf Wiedersehen.